Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts, hear stories from the emergency department, and listen to people who have struggled from addiction. Friends, fentanyl is plaguing America. It has infected all illicit drugs, from cocaine to meth, counterfeit pills, and even marijuana. If you're around someone who may be using drugs, you should carry naloxone, the opioid reversal agent. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. If you need a prescription for naloxone, you should have one. No questions asked. That is why I am offering a free prescription to anyone who needs one. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show, submit a question, or download a free prescription for naloxone. And if you like the show, do me a favor. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe. Your stars are very much appreciated and go a long way in supporting the program. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on breaking the status quo of failed solutions and to get to the core of the supply chain of deadly fentanyl. Learn more about FAF by visiting familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illegal fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a stimulating conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. There are many types of stimulations, but we're going to talk about the stimulation on the brain. And perhaps you're thinking methamphetamine and cocaine, those are known stimulants, but we're going to talk about physical stimulation on the brain. Deep brain stimulation, DBS, uses a surgically implanted device that goes into the brain and stimulates a specific section of the brain. Deep brain stimulation is the most common surgery for patients with Parkinson's disease. Electrodes are placed on either side of the subthalamic nucleus or the globus pallidus interna, the parts of the brain that control movement. And the electrodes in the brain are connected to a battery placed under the skin like a pacemaker. This surgery can help a subset of patients with Parkinson's disease. Michael J. Fox, famous actor of the sitcom Family Ties and the movie Back to the Future, had this procedure to treat his Parkinson's disease. That's all talk about brain surgery for Parkinson's disease. What does that have to do with High Truths and drugs and addiction? Well, both Parkinson's disease and substance use disorder are diseases of the brain, and both affect dopamine. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hi, Dr. Lev. Thank you for your High Truths podcast. My name is Micheline Hearn. I really enjoy your podcast, and I really appreciate getting to work with you in the hospital. I'm interested in the issue of addiction, and you showcase many aspects of the problem. My question is about treatment of very severe substance use disorders. Are there options for people when medications and therapy just don't work? Thank you.
Thank you, Micheline, for your question and your A-plus nursing care in the emergency department. You have a very difficult and stressful job, and you carried out with grace and excellence. So thank you for that. And to answer your question, I have reached out to an expert who I found that we may call upon when all else fails to treat addiction and some innovation hopes for the future. Dr. James Mahoney is an associate professor and clinical neuropsychologist in the Department of Behavioral Medicine and Psychiatry and the Department of Neuroscience at the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute in West Virginia University School of Medicine. I watched his interview on CNN about experimental brain surgery and thought, wow, brain surgery for addiction? I have to learn more. And I reached out to Dr. James Mahoney. To learn more about James Mahoney and read his interview with CNN, please check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. James Mahoney, welcome to High Truths.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I'm really excited for a stimulating conversation with you. You are a neuroscientist, right?
Correct. Yes. So I'm a neuropsychologist, and I work at the West Virginia University School of Medicine and the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute.
And that means you like the brain, but you chose to focus on the brain on addiction. And tell us about that.
Absolutely. So, about 20 years ago now, I started working in a clinical research lab out at the University of California, Los Angeles, working on medication development for stimulant dependence. And then, you know, throughout my course of my research career, I went through and got my PhD in psychology, did postdoctoral training as a clinical neuropsychologist, and ended up at the West Virginia University School of Medicine, where focusing less on medication development and more on forms of what we call neuromodulation for the treatment of addiction.
Fascinating. And I think I read about your work. You actually do brain surgery in a way to help addiction.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So we have an FDA regulated and protocol that's funded through the National Institute of Drug Abuse. That's looking at deep brain stimulation for treatment refractory opioid use disorder.
That sounds fascinating. I think our audience needs to like perk up like what? Brain surgery for addiction? But I think in order to really understand what you're doing, we need a little basic lesson on the brain. If you could tell us about parts of the brain that are affected by addiction, so then we could understand the modalities better of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Happy to. So, you know, addiction, and it's truly a brain disease. You know, the addicted brain, it's not just one area of the brain that's affected. It's several different areas, several different brain circuits and brain networks that become disrupted when addiction sets in. The area of the brain that we view as the pleasure center, the reward center of the brain, is the nucleus accumbens. That's the center of the reward circuitry. There's other areas, the frontal lobes, that's involved with decision-making, inhibitory control. Those are also heavily involved in the reward circuitry. So what we're doing with this protocol is we're implanting the deep brain stimulator on the nucleus accumbens as a way to increase dopamine in that area, which then flows throughout the rest of the reward circuitry and hopefully improves decision-making, reduces drug cravings, and hopefully, you know, assists the individual remain abstinent from substances.
So Micheline is a nurse that I work with in the emergency department who does amazing jobs and really cares nicely for patients. We treat a lot of patients with substance use disorder and see a lot of resistance. And so the question is, when behavioral therapy doesn't work, with medications fail, and we see an enormous amount of recidivism in the emergency department, what are options? What are some of the options to treat substance use disorder when everything else is failing?
Absolutely. So, you know, when you look at a treatment such as deep brain stimulation, it's obviously not currently, nor is it ever going to be a first line treatment. So it's for individuals that, you know, have tried different methods of treatment, whether it be outpatient treatment, residential, detox. They keep trying different forms of treatment, more intensive treatments, and just can't find success. So, you know, there's a high rate of drug use recurrences or relapse amongst these individuals. So we're looking at this protocol as for to apply to patients who are truly treatment refractory. So they've tried several different, whether it's medications in combination with behavioral treatment, but they still cannot sustain abstinence.
Right. So there is some hope for these patients.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as part of this NIDA funded protocol, there's two phases. There was a first phase, which included four patients, where the primary focus was safety and tolerability and really feasibility. As soon as we got through that phase, now we've moved on to a larger clinical trial. You know, we got some initial efficacy data from the first four patients, very promising results. And NIDA has approved that we can move on to the next phase, which will be in 20 additional patients, and it'll be randomized as well. So we'll be able to control and see exactly how well deep brain stimulation works for reducing substance use, as well as those risk factors for relapse, such as substance cravings, cognitive functioning, emotional symptoms, those various risk factors.
That's fascinating. So I read from your story with CNN about one of the patients who came forward, Gerald Buchalter. So tell us about this patient who qualified for the surgery.
Absolutely. Yeah. So he was the first patient that was enrolled in the trial at WVU. And he's an individual that I had known for several years, through my work with the Comprehensive Opioid Addiction Treatment Program, or COAT program for short. That is the main primary addiction treatment program at West Virginia University. We have over 650 patients currently enrolled, various stages of treatment, depending on how successful individuals are in their recovery. So it starts off more intensive. That includes, weekly visits to meet with a psychiatrist to prescribe the medication, as well as group counseling and then individual therapy as well. For individuals that come in on a weekly basis but still are struggling to maintain their sobriety, we have what we call the intensive COPE program, which requires that individuals come in three times a week. So it's more points of contact. To really kind of give more structure to the patient's schedule. And that's something where our first research participant was in that intensive COPE program, kept coming back for treatment, but was still struggling and still relapsing frequently.
So he's a compliant patient. He's not really patients I see in the emergency department who are not following up, not going to the doctor. Here are individuals, including Gerald, who's actually going to the doctor three times a week and still struggling.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah. So this type of protocol, since it is the first of its kind being conducted here in the United States, it's FDA regulated. One of the biggest, components of it is monitoring safety to make sure that, patients aren't having any medical side effects, struggling and relapsing frequently and have any major safety concerns. So that's one of the requirements for inclusion in the protocol, is that they have to be, treatment refractory. That is, they haven't responded well to the current treatment, the standard of care, but they have to keep coming back. So it's a difficult population to recruit for. All of the participants that have been enrolled have fit that criteria thus far.
And Gerald's addiction was opioids?
He was and that's one of the things that we see as well. So in the Comprehensive Opioid Addiction Treatment Program, everyone is there and they receive, medication for opioid use disorder. So they receive some form of buprenorphine. But the problem is that they're very rarely just have an opioid use disorder. It's really, more the exception to have just an opioid use disorder than the norm. So polysubstance use and co-occurring substance use is definitely what we see more of, usually at least two, many times three, four, five different types of substances.
Right.
So, the first patient enrolled in the trial, as well as the third, sedatives with benzodiazepines were also their drug of choice. So there's certainly, polysubstance use is what we're seeing. The great thing about being able to target the center of the reward circuitry is that while medications like buprenorphine are fantastic for controlling opioid cravings, they don't do anything for benzo cravings or for methamphetamine cravings. By targeting the center of the reward circuitry, the nucleus accumbens, we're able to control cravings for all addictive substances because it's regulating that dopamine, the pleasure neurochemical. It's really bringing it back to their baseline so that they're able to enjoy the normal things in life again and not feel as dependent on different substances.
Right. I'm able to talk about Gerald. I mean, usually we talk about patients, they're HIPAA protected, but he openly talked about his story on CNN. So we're able to talk about him without breaking confidentiality because it's already out in the newspaper on his, on his will. But Gerald was addicted to several different drugs, right? Opioids, I think Xanax you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For many years. Jared has a very long standing history. And, you know, once again, you know, very, very dedicated to coming back to treatment, but was definitely struggling with multiple substances.
And how old is Gerald?
He's in his 30s.
In his 30s. And I saw also from the newspaper, he had a great support because his parents are very involved in his care as well.
That's correct. Yes. And that's another requirement for study inclusion is that they have to have a strong support system. And that could be, you know, parents, siblings, you know, very close, you know, sponsors are in the recovery community. Because that's one of the most important in situations like this, and the neurosurgeon will even say it, the surgery is the easy part. It's what happens afterwards. It's right. What happens with the treatment and kind of getting back to the normalcy of life again. And without that support, it makes it very, very, very difficult.
So Gerald is trying everything, MAT, coming to doctors many times a week. And now you're thinking, maybe this is a good surgical candidate. What other tests go before you even think about that? Do you do PET scans, MRIs? Do you do genetic testing? I'm wondering if he had you're able to find a genetic disposition or find a gene there that he may have for addiction, or do you able to see parts of his brains that may be affected even before going into surgery?
So we don't do any genetic testing, but short of that, we do everything else. You know, in terms of the inclusion, exclusion criteria, very, very extensive list, you know, of different criteria that needs to be met. So everyone needs to be medically stable otherwise than having, you know, treatment refractory opioid use disorder. They have to also be at very high risk of death. Because as I mentioned, this is never going to be a first line of treatment. And if we're going to go as far as having brain surgery, there has to be a high risk of death. There has to be life-threatening disease present. So we require that they have to have had multiple overdoses in the past. Mm-hmm. And then we do very thorough medical workup. We do MRIs, we do PET scans, we do CT scans. All the blood work, so very thorough, you know.
And are you seeing parts of the brain? You know how they show us that NIDA has beautiful pictures of the brain on drugs and, you know, holes in the brain for people using methamphetamines or even parts of the brain that look different, absorption of dopamine on people who have addiction versus people who don't. Were you able to see that in your patients?
Yeah. So with, that's one of the, this is why it's very difficult to recruit for this type of studies because their brain, you know, has to be otherwise functioning normally. So they obviously can't have any sort of tumors or have any sort of lesions or evidence of, any sort of severe traumatic brain injury. So we're not necessarily seeing the damage that would be, caused by years and years and years of substance use. We do monitor beforehand and, we do the MRIs and the CT scans beforehand. And then we also monitor it afterwards as an outcome to see if there's any changes over time.
But you're not doing the kind of imaging that NIDA does that looks at dopamine uptake and to that
actually,
degree.
I don't do
that in the hospital. I'm an emergency physician. And whenever I see those images from NIDA, I'm thinking, oh, that's kind of interesting. We don't have that technology in the hospitals. I was wondering if you'd do that.
Yeah. So in the past, the pilot study with four patients, we looked at FDG PET. So we did PET scanning. And then we also, in this next phase, we're going to be combining that with thalidomide. So we'll be able to look at the dopamine uptake to see really more about the dopamine release.
So you're able to see, and were you able to do in these patients, were you able to see these PET scans and before and after and seeing if fascinating.
Yes. We're currently in the process of analyzing all of that, but, we're going to be able to see if there, our thought is that there's going to be increased, obviously increased blood flow and circulation within the frontal lobes going down through the reward circuitry, based on their achieved abstinence, as well as, their improved, life circumstances.
Oh, fascinating. So Gerald becomes, qualified to have the surgery. He consents. And now you get a neurosurgeon to do, first time ever in the world, brain surgery for someone with addiction. And is this something any neurosurgeon could do, or did this specialized ability to find the nucleus accumbens, or is that just as easy as, you know, putting a stimulator for, say, with Parkinson's? Is there a difference in the technique?
Mm-hmm. So it's a different area of the brain that's typically used for Parkinson's. Dr. Ali Rezai, he's the PI of the project. He's a neurosurgeon. He's the director. He's the head of the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute. So, you know, definitely a world-renowned neurosurgeon and researcher as well. Has been performing novel projects in surgeries for different disorders, including psychiatric disorders that haven't been looked at before. As far as the team between the neurosurgery team and the behavioral medicine team that we have through the COPE program, it was just a perfect match.
Wow. And so is the technique different than putting a stimulator? Or maybe take us through the technique. What is Dr. Rezai doing?
Absolutely. So the surgery lasts, a little over half a day. And what he'll do is the stimulator, obviously the electrode, which has these four different nodules on it, will go into the brain. So he'll put it into the brain, and then he'll attach to the nucleus accumbens. That's where we implant. And then the wires come back around here above the skull and under the skin. And then it attaches to a pulse generator right here, which is like a pacemaker, which really just provides the stimulation, a battery.
So are you drilling a hole in the brain, in the skull?
A very small burr hole, yes.
Yeah. I think of like a cardiologist putting in a pacemaker. They do it, you know, under fluoroscopy, or they could see kind of where they're going. How do you do that on the brain?
Right. So that's why we do so many MRIs beforehand, really just to get the targeting just right and kind of knowing exactly where we want to go. And then it's all image guided. So we're able to tell the density of how far down we're going. And then it comes down to the surgical skill. And then once the electrodes are placed, that's when we test it, and we're testing it in real time. The patient is awake during this. And we're able to test it in real time by measuring behavioral effects of craving, emotional responses. And a lot of it's based on, observation as well. So if we see more smiling, we know that we're in the right area. Because the accumbens is also, it's not just craving, but it's also associated with anxiety and happiness and those feelings too.
So you're putting this like electrode in the brain, and the way you're going to tell if you're in the right place, again, I'm trying to compare it to cardiac, pacing, that's, when you could actually see when you're in the right place, but you actually have people smile or laugh, or how do you what are you asking them while they're awake and this probes are in their brain?
That's exactly it. So during the procedure itself, they're actually, the patients are awake and they're looking at different images of substances. So they're looking at, people using their substances of choice. We're able to tailor it to the substances the patient uses. So they're able to look at the drugs themselves, people using the drugs, drug paraphernalia. And we're asking them constantly to give their ratings, usually on a visual analog scale from 0 to 10, 10 being the most craving ever. So we do that at baseline. And then throughout the surgery, when we turn the stimulator on, when we test the different electrode contacts, we ask them those same questions. And once we get placed in the right area, that's when, we'll start seeing the craving ratings drop. They'll become more talkative. You'll see some facial expressions change. A variety of different ways to measure, in real time during the surgery, the effectiveness of it.
That's fascinating. What's the difference between doing the surgery for addiction and doing the same deep brain stimulator? I assume it's the same device as what's used for Parkinson's. And is it the same device?
So yes, it is the same device. Obviously the outcome measures are quite different. When you think about, DBS for Parkinson's, when you're going in and you're testing to see if the best settings, because there's so many, there's thousands upon thousands of different settings that you can have in terms of the frequency and the pulse width, and it can be individualized to treat the patient's symptoms. So when they're doing that for Parkinson's and tremor, you know, they're able to measure. So once they get the right parameters, you'll see the tremor just stop. With addiction, it's a lot different. If it was easy enough to measure addiction by, you know, physically like this, you know, that would be one thing. But, you know, trying to measure craving and, you know, more of the kind of emotional responsiveness to stimulation, that's a little bit different. So it takes more time to really find the right settings. And, you know, that takes place in an inpatient setting. After the surgery, we give them time to recover. And then afterwards, during that time, the stimulator hasn't been turned on yet. We'll turn it on during what we call the titration phase. And that's where we really optimize it as best as we can for an inpatient setting to find the right settings before we discharge them to the outpatient setting.
Interesting. So in comparison, again, to the deep brain stimulator for Parkinson's and for addiction, it's the same device. In Parkinson's, you're targeting the motor part of the brain. And in addiction, you're targeting the nucleus accumbens. And both diseases involve dopamine. So is there similarities in that as well?
Yeah. So, you know, for specific to addiction, the dopamine, the way that we conceptualize it is that when an individual, you know, we all start off with a level of dopamine kind of right about here. Okay. And then when somebody uses the substance, their dopamine goes up. So that's what makes them feel high. That's what gives them the euphoric feeling. And then they withdraw and they come back down. So then they use again and it goes up again. But over time, what happens is that their dopamine, their baseline level of dopamine decreases so that they're just using to get back to their baseline. So they're not necessarily using to get high anymore. They're using just to get back to their baseline. So what we're hoping to do with the stimulation is just rather than have the dopamine levels low, just bring them back to where they were before they started using. That way they'll have more success with you know, adhering to the standard level of care. We don't view DBS as, you know, just flipping the addiction switch. We don't think that we're going to be able to just, you know, shut off addiction completely solely with this treatment. It's meant to be an adjunctive strategy with, you know, those standard of care approaches, such as the comprehensive opioid addiction treatment program or other behavioral health programs.
And with Parkinson's, it's different, right? Mm-hmm. You're not, the stimulation is not in order to create dopamine. Parkinson's patients need to take dopamine pills, right?
Correct. Yes. And usually if you're looking at deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's or for tremor, it's because they've become refractory. The medications aren't working as well. So it will be to increase dopamine in those areas of the brain as well and to regulate the dopamine in those areas. A lot of times, once again, you know, in combination with medicine as well, you know, in combination.
So if, and this may be a silly question, but if addiction is relative dopamine depletion state, mm-hmm. would the same medications for Parkinson's, dopamine, carbidopa, would that be working in people with addiction? I know we don't do that, but I'm wondering if it follows some of that principle.
We don't. And I'm not, you know, there has been some work done with medications like carbidopa earlier on. For some reason, the long-term effects, as far as I know, and I can't speak with absolute certainty, it wasn't as effective. But once again, I can't speak with certainty that.
Interesting. So you have now outcomes on your four initial patients, right?
Correct. Yes.
So how are they doing? How's Gerald doing? And how are the other patients doing?
So yes, everyone's doing really well. You know, we, like I said, four patients, the individuals that are still enrolled are all doing well. You know, we've seen increases in, you know, functional outcomes as well. You know, we've had the participants go on to be peer recovery coaches and really just really involve themselves in the recovery community and helping others as well. And then, like as I mentioned earlier, reductions in depression, reductions in anxiety, you know, craving has obviously been improved.
But do they need less medications? Do they need less buprenorphine or other of their medications as a result of the surgery?
Yeah. So they're all still in behavioral treatment. And there has been some reductions in their medications just to really see, you know, because as they've gotten more and more days of abstinence, they've needed less of that as well. So, you know, it's really, we like, as I mentioned earlier, we don't necessarily think that it should ever kind of just take away the need for buprenorphine, because buprenorphine, like medications and insulin, like insulin for diabetes, it's really going to be lifelong management of the addiction. So, you know, that's something that, of course, we would explore if the patient was really, you know, dead set on you know, discontinuing their medication for opioid use disorder. We would work with them on it and kind of explain, you know, what the outcomes might be. And if the side effect profile isn't there, it might be kind of worth, you know, staying on the medication. But that's something that we'd always be up for discussing with them, of course.
So brain surgery for addiction is not a quick fix, and you still have an addiction even after the surgery.
Absolutely. And that's one of the, you know, before we consent the patient and, you know, we meet with them extensively and we meet with their support system. And that's really what we need to drive home, is that this is not a quick fix. You know, it took years to get to where they were, to be sitting in front of me and the treatment team. It's not going to be fixed overnight. And it's going to take, you know, hard work. But at the same time, we view this as an opportunity for them to get their lives back. As I mentioned earlier, they have life-threatening disease. They have past history of overdoses. With the amount of fentanyl that's on the street today, and you know, the methamphetamine, which is much more potent, the risk of death is very much present. So even though it's going to take a lot of hard work, you know, I believe these patients, they realize that there's a need for something more.
Right. I think, and again, that the compliance that you have and the patients that you selected, I think it amazes me, being able to come in and that means that they really want to get better also.
Absolutely.
So now you're on the next phase, 20 patients that you're recruiting, or you already have?
That's correct. Yeah. So we recently received FDA approval to move on with the larger clinical trial.
Congratulations. And,
thank you so much. Yes.
And I know there's a lot of work behind those, behind that approval.
There is. So, you know, we have a lot of support, you know, from the National Institute of Health, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, that they certainly see the value in this potential treatment. You know, they were everyone is very excited about the results from the first phase. So yeah, we're definitely looking forward to getting started and really hope to consent and enroll the first patient within the next couple of months.
That's amazing. And then what happens after that? Tell us, when does it come like on the market? What's your estimate for that?
Right. So it's really obviously very difficult to tell. You know, there's been, you know, as far as the FDA approval process to get it covered by insurance, you know, we're looking at a very long process for that, I would imagine. You know, but we're really hopeful that the results of this next phase, the clinical trial.
And long, do you mean 2 years, 10 years?
Yeah, probably, you know, I would say probably closer to 10 than two. Wow. Unfortunately. But you can't tell. I mean, you know, things can obviously change in terms of regulations and the fast tracking of devices. It's too soon to tell.
And the market is just going to be used for different purposes.
Correct. Yeah. So the device we use is with Medtronic. So they've been a collaborator of ours. So we've been working closely with them with analyzing the data and, you know, just making sure that everything runs right from the device perspective.
Very interesting tactics for people with very severe resistant disease. There is some other alternatives out there. And not just deep brain stimulation. You said that your research is about neuromodulation, and there are other things that can be done to the brain. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Yes. So there's several different types of forms of neuromodulation. Some are invasive, like deep brain stimulation. Some are non-invasive. An example of that would be transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is currently approved for depression. But there's been a lot of very positive and hopeful findings using transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS for short, for addiction as well, across a variety of different substances.
So I did a podcast once with Fisher about using the transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's not that expensive, right? It's less than $300. And remind us how that works.
Absolutely. So with the unlike DBS, which we target very deep areas of the brain, what we call subcortical areas of the brain, TMS uses a magnet that just goes on the outside of the brain, and then or the outside of the skull, and it delivers the current. It can't reach those very deep areas, but it can reach, you know, the prefrontal cortex. We look at the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And that area is very heavily involved with decision-making and inhibitory control, which are also often disrupted in individuals with addiction.
And what kind of results is that? It's not yet approved for addiction, right? It's approved for depression. And I think you could even buy it over the counter and try it for depression, but not for addiction. Is that right?
So TMS, there was recently a device, and this is going back only a few months, for it was FDA approved for nicotine dependence. There were some very positive findings there. So it has been approved for that, but it's really still, there's been a lot of work done, but it's still in the preliminary stages for addiction. There's still a lot of work to be done for other substances. But, you know, it's been, you know, looked at for opioids and methamphetamine, alcohol. So we're continuing our efforts there as well.
It would make sense because a lot of substance use disorder has overlap with depression, right? So it may be hard to know what's, you know, chicken of the egg kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. The comorbidity that between depression and anxiety, you know, we look at, we talk about the opioid epidemic and, you know, the addiction epidemic, and it really is, I consider it more just a maladaptive coping epidemic, because that's what substance use is. It's when you can't physically remove yourself from a situation or from, you know, a stressor, whether it's an emotional stressor or physical stressor. You know, substance use gives you the opportunity to do that. You know, so it works. It, you know, substance use works at doing that, at kind of, you know, numbing any sort of pain, whether it's emotional or physical pain, but it doesn't work forever.
Right. And then there's serious adverse outcomes, including dying.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Exactly.
And the other thing that I saw that you do is ultrasound. How does ultrasound work for addiction?
Yeah. So with focused ultrasound, it's also non-invasive like TMS. But unlike DBS, it's non-invasive. So we're able to, you know, target deep areas of the brain. So TMS, we're not able to target those deep areas. Focused ultrasound, you can. And basically, it's MR guided, so they use magnetic resonance, and the individual has a helmet on, and they go into an MRI machine, which is where we're able to precisely target the area of the brain, which in this case would be the nucleus accumbens. And the sonication happens, and there's all these transducers on this helmet. And so not, you know, there's not one particular area of the brain that gets too much of the ultrasound. It comes from these thousands of different transducers. And you're able to really pinpoint the exact location that, you know, with great precision that you want to modulate.
And are you targeting the same nucleus accumbens?
That's correct. Yes.
And so I'm wondering, so did your patients who got the brain surgery, did they try these other things first or no?
So the focused ultrasound right now is very preliminary. It's very new. You know, we're conducting a pilot trial right now. You know, with hopeful results, but there's going to be a lot more research that's needed. You know, focused ultrasound, it's currently approved, FDA approved. They have high intensity and low intensity focused ultrasound. High intensity is used for Parkinson's disease as well. With high intensity, you're actually able to ablate the area of the brain that's causing the tremor. We're not doing that with addiction. We're using it more for neuromodulation. So we use low intensity.
Is that kind of like, for people who have, you know, atrial fibrillation, they go through an ablation of that circuitry of the heart. You can do that in the brain?
Yep, with great precision so that it doesn't affect other areas. So you're able to get at the area that's causing the tremor. And by doing so, you're able to stop the tremor, but not affect other processes. So you're not affecting anything cognitively, you know, and it's really shown some very positive results.
Wow. And that's FDA approved?
FDA, yes.
It seems like kind of like following a Parkinson's path, like things are approved for Parkinson's, and now we're going to try to apply it for addiction.
Yep, absolutely. When it comes down to the whole dopamine hypothesis, and you know, if our thoughts are, you know, don't reinvent the wheel if we don't have to. Obviously, for different indications, you're targeting different areas of the brain, and you have to look at outcomes differently because, you know, as we talked about earlier, looking at a physical tremor versus emotional cravings and anxiety and depression are very different, you know, characteristics to measure and assess. But yeah, we're definitely going to follow, you know, what's worked in the past.
Interesting. So that's a neuromodulation. The other part of your research that you talked about is studying cognitive sequela of substance use disorder. Can you explain what does that mean?
Absolutely. So as a neuropsychologist, obviously, you know, with cognitive and thinking processes, that's something that I'm drawn to. We know that individuals that have substance use disorder and have used various substances have cognitive side effects over time. We know that with these side effects, you know, treatment outcomes are poorer for individuals that have cognitive deficits. So they drop out of treatment at a faster rate. They're unlikely to be able to really fully engage in treatment once they begin. So what I focus on as well is really identifying those cognitive deficits early on in treatment so that their treatment course can be individualized. They can focus more on, you know, cognitive rehabilitation, cognitive remediation.
What is cognitive deficit? Because when I think about cognitive deficit, I think people are disoriented or can't think so well, or confused, or can't learn.
Absolutely. So we're looking at, you know, it's all of those things. So, you know, with prolonged substance use, we see deficits in especially in frontal functions. So, you know, the frontal lobe controlling attention and processing speed, executive functions. So those higher order processes, we see that those are often impaired in individuals that have used substances for several years. So when those areas of thinking become impaired, they're going to struggle more when they start behavioral treatment. So they're not going to be able to, you know, learn the relapse prevention techniques that they're taught. And then if they are able to learn them, have difficulty actually, you know, applying them in their everyday life. So if you're able to identify these individuals earlier on that have these deficits, you can build in an extra arm to their treatment, which can focus on, you know, rebuilding their cognitive skills.
Interesting. I wonder what tests you do in order to check that. I was reminded of a patient I saw last night. I admitted to the hospital because his blood sugar was too high. He was already in the hospital before for high blood sugar. And I said, did anybody teach him? I mean, we never send people home with diabetes without teaching them how to use their insulin and glucose monitor. That's very basic. We make sure. And I was wondering why you never got the materials, didn't get them. And clearly the social worker said, like, you know, he would not pay attention.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes. And that's one of the things. So it's whether or not it's like the acute intoxication, is that what's causing the cognitive deficits? Or if this is just from prolonged use, if this is just kind of the residual effects from prolonged use. So that's what I try to do, you know, clinically, try to really tease out and see if we can correct any of those cognitive impairments, see if we can improve cognitive functioning, build in, you know, different types of strategies. You know, a lot of times it's based on compensatory strategies. So if we find out that they're a better visual learner than verbal learner, then we'll provide them with the information they learn in treatment in visual format as well, so that they can, you know, practice and repeat and, you know, really individualize.
Give us an example of that, of what a question that you do. Is it like, you know, what's name three objects and see if you remember them, or like what is a?
So we do formal, you know, they're extensive neuropsychological batteries. So they take about, you know, 4 or 5 hours. And we look at various things. So, you know, we do some screening measures like the mini mental, you know, 30 question, just a quick assessment to look at things like memory, you know, give them three objects, ask them to repeat it, you know, recall it a few seconds later. But the more extensive ones get at problem solving. We do like list learning, and then we ask them to give us as many words that they can remember after 20 minutes. Different types of processing speed tests. So very comprehensive, just so that we can tease apart all the different deficits that we see and really, you know, find out the best ways to help that individual.
Wow. Dr. Mahoney, you do such fascinating work. What are some other research projects that you're working on? Are you doing just research? You see patients? What are you currently working on?
Yeah, so I do still see patients as part of my clinical responsibilities, which is something that I love, which is why I got into it in the first place. So I see a wide variety. I'm more of a generalist when it comes to being a neuropsychologist. So I'll see anything, obviously addiction and psychiatric and behavioral medicine referrals, but I'll see everything from movement disorders to epilepsy, Alzheimer's, all the different types of dementias, perform neuropsychological assessments on these individuals, work with their treatment teams and come in terms of coming up with recommendations to help them with their day-to-day living. And then as far as research goes, I try to mentor and I try to be there for, junior faculty and graduate students and trainees and really try to help them, understand the importance of research, but also, understand that it could be fun too, that some of the work we're doing is really exciting. It's certainly groundbreaking, and really just trying to help them, understand the importance and work with others.
It is exciting. And anything else on the research horizon? What's your, any big projects you wish you had or that you would want to work on?
The work that I'm doing now, if you were to ask me 10 years ago if I'd be doing this type of work, I probably wouldn't have said I would be, because this is groundbreaking at a whole new level that I didn't think was possible. So working on something like a deep brain stimulation for addiction protocol, it makes sense. I didn't necessarily think that I would be as heavily involved in conducting it as I am, which is fantastic. So yeah, it just lets us know, and especially, letting the patients know that there's a lot of people that are out there still working on figuring this out and figuring out how to conquer addiction. And we're thinking outside the box as much as we possibly can. And, we know that medications can be helpful. We know the behavioral treatments can be helpful, but it's obviously not helpful for everybody. So I really still want to instill that hope in people that are still struggling or have loved ones that are struggling, that there's a lot of very talented people that are working, endlessly to really, put an end to addiction.
Yeah. Give it treatment like we have for, like you said, diabetes or Parkinson's disease. Thank you to Micheline for your stimulating question that led to discussion on brain stimulators. And thank you for your great work in the emergency department, caring for patients, saving lives every day, every shift. And thank you to you, Dr. James Mahoney, for your stimulating conversation and all the amazing work that you're doing and leading a team. Really, the patients are so fortunate to have that type of attention. And I think it gives us a lot of hope that our nation is investing in out-of-the-box ideas to treat addiction that's really killing so many people and hurting families.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come talk today.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support from our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign the petition to declare illegal fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Make drug dealers think twice and three times before peddling killer drugs. Our producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.